Did you know there was a time when the Republican Party was the party of equal rights and the Democratic Party was the party of white supremacy?
We have the Republican, the party of equal rights in office in New Orleans, and we have this town of Colfax, which has a city authority, a town authority. And a number of white supremacists in the area had been kicked out when they tried to take over town government, and they decided to take it back.
That's Lawrence Goldstone. We talk with him about his book, Unpunished Murder, Massacre at Colfax and the Quest for Justice. Then, remember when Elizabeth Warren stood up in the Senate to read Coretta Scott King's letter about then-nominee Jeff Sessions?
And that's a perfect example of this mantra that I've repeated throughout the book, insist, resist, persist.
That's Susan Wood. We talk with her about her picture book for grade schoolers, Elizabeth Warren, Nevertheless, She Persisted. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Today, as I produce this episode, the news is sinking in that President Trump intends to make an executive order that would overturn a fundamental right written into the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. That's the right to citizenship for every individual born in the U.S. It was passed to right a wrong, to bring African Americans freed from slavery by the Emancipation Proclamation into the body politic as full citizens. My guest, author Lawrence Goldstone, is a freelance constitutional scholar of sorts. Among his many books have been several focusing on issues of racial justice and constitutional rights. Now he's come out with a page-turner that examines racial justice in the context of a terrible massacre in Louisiana in 1873. The book is called Unpunished Murder, Massacre at Colfax and the Quest for Justice. The massacre in question occurred during an assault on a black community in Colfax, Louisiana, that had been established by freedmen seeking a better life. What happened to the perpetrators has repercussions that continue to reverberate in our body politic today. Lawrence Goldstone, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
This is just a terrific book, Unpunished Murder, Massacre at Colfax, and the Quest for Justice. It's a history of some of the most important jurisprudence in the U.S., especially as it relates to race, discrimination, and voting rights. But a massacre is at the heart of it. Briefly tell us about that massacre and the context in which it happened.
Well, after the Civil War, as most people know, African Americans were given a number of rights, at least supposedly given a number of rights, that they had not had before. There were 4 million freed slaves, newly freed slaves, and the aim was to incorporate these 4 million people into American society in a manner which was going to be extremely difficult because you were dealing with a population that was largely illiterate through no fault of their own and who lacked certain social training, again, through no fault of their own. And it could be considered the largest experiment in social engineering ever undertaken. And as part of this, there were a number of communities throughout the South which built themselves up into thriving towns and cities. And one of them was a place called Colfax, Louisiana, which was in Grant Parish. And these were carved out of other territories. Grant Parish was named for Ulysses Grant. And Colfax, the county seat, was named for his vice president, Schuyler Colfax. And there was a thriving African-American community there, which did not arouse good feelings of much of the local white population, which was dominated by white supremacists. Louisiana politics at the time was impossibly corrupt, and in 1872 they had a gubernatorial election between the Republican, who was a carpetbagger, and a Democrat, who was a decorated Confederate war veteran. And that election was so corrupt on both sides that to this day nobody can be certain who won. People have tried to figure it out. But both of them declared victory. Both of them had victory celebrations. Both of them talked about how they were going to govern the state. And but it was eventually decided in the courts, and the courts were dominated by Republicans, so you can guess who wins. After the Republican was declared the winner...
And when you say Republicans, that's very different from the Republicans of today.
The Republican Party was then the party of equality, and the Democratic Party was the party of white supremacy, which is kind of different now to some significant degree. So we have the Republican, the party of equal rights, in office in New Orleans, and we have this town of Colfax, which has a city authority, a town authority. And the a number of white supremacists in the area had been kicked out when they tried to take over town government. And they decided to take it back. And on Easter Sunday, April 14th, I believe, 1873, about 150 of them, heavily armed, most of them Confederate War veterans, toting a four-pound cannon behind them that they had borrowed from a riverboat, invaded the town. And the town was defended by 150 African-Americans who were armed, but with antiquated shotguns that could hardly shoot. And there was no question as to who would win in a fight. And very, very soon after the confrontation took place, the African-Americans gave up. The 150 whites, who was about equal on both sides, gathered, they confiscated all the weapons, then they proceeded to slaughter their captives. There were as many as 100 African-American men were either shot, stabbed to death, and some of them were burned to death in a courthouse. And this is what is dubbed the Colfax Massacre, or the Colfax Riot, depending on what your political orientation was. Now, aware that Louisiana authorities, even with a Republican governor and Republican courts, were not going to move against the white invaders, the white murderers, the federal government moved to indict 98 of them under the Enforcement Act of 1870, which was a law that was passed to give teeth to the 14th Amendment. And three of them were convicted, and one of them was named Cruikshank. And these three appealed to the United States Supreme Court on the grounds that the 14th Amendment had no right to legislate the behavior of private, ordinary people and ordinary crimes, which, well, the men were convicted of violating the black men's civil rights because murder is a state crime, but it was under this 14th Amendment-inspired law, the Enforcement Act of 1870. And Cruikshank and two of his cronies, who were convicted, were the only men convicted, appealed to the United States Supreme Court. And in May of 1876, it took that long, which was only a few weeks before the centennial in Philadelphia, celebrating 100 years of freedom, in May of 1876, the Supreme Court, under new Chief Justice Morrison Waite, who was called firmly in the first rank of second rank lawyers, freed the three men, agreeing that the 14th Amendment could not legislate the behavior of ordinary people. Therefore, the Enforcement Act of 1870 was unconstitutional. And for one of the most heinous mass murders in American history, nobody was punished.
Thanks for laying that out so well. Now, one of the things that's fascinating about your book, Lawrence Goldstone, is how individual people made critical decisions at critical times to change the meaning of the law. That history isn't just about the laws, but about the people who make them and enforce them.
Yeah, one thing should be said. Unpunished murder is aimed, it's the first, I've written three other books on constitutional law. This is the first one aimed at high school and middle school, but it's actually also aimed at parents, because most adults, if you say, oh, I have this terrific book on constitutional law for you to read, they're going to go, you know, that's terrific, but I, you know, as soon as I'm finished, whatever else they're reading. But this is an entry, because I did it from a human point of view, and because I took great care to try to frame all the legal issues in terms of doing it in ways that were comprehensible to ordinary people, and I hope interesting, this is an entry point to constitutional law and the Supreme Court that parents, I hope, will be as interested in as their children.
And it's really living history. So let's talk about the Supreme Court. give us a brief history of how it was set up and tell us about John Marshall.
Now, when the Constitutional Convention met in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787, 12 states were represented. Rhode Island didn't send anyone. Rhode Island was called Rogues Island at the time because they were freewheeling. They just believed in doing anything you can get away with. And it was a great fear because the United States at that time was not 13 states as much as 13 separate countries. People's identification, people's allegiance was to their state first and to this country, this kind of loosely formed federation second. And in order to make a real country, you needed to strengthen the central government, which scared a lot of people a lot. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that scared them the most is a federal court system. Because if you had to go stand trial in federal court, for most people, and the people, the judges were from a different state, as they probably would be, it would be like going and standing in judgment in front of foreigners. So Article 3, if you look at Article 1, the legislature, it's really, really, really long. And Article 2, the president, the executive, is kind of long, but not as long. And Article 3 is tiny, because the country couldn't afford a central federal court system. They didn't want particularly a federal court system, certainly not a strong one. So in Article 3, for example, the only court that is mentioned is a Supreme Court. How many justices? Does not say. How many courts under it? Does not say. And Article 3 also gives Congress the right to determine what jurisdiction the court will have. Now, the Federalist Party, which was George Washington and John Adams, and at the time Thomas Jefferson, although he switched, knew they were going to be ruling. And they wanted to give the federal government, including the courts, the most flexibility they could. So a lot of the Constitution was written to be vague. And the first president is George Washington, of course. By the way, in that first election, the percentage of the population that was eligible to vote for president, take a guess.
50%?
Six out of 100, every 100 Americans was eligible to vote. So George Washington wins the first term, he wins the second term, he turns down the third term, John Adams is elected. Adams is particularly unpopular for a number of reasons, and in the election of 18, it's the fourth election, Jefferson beats Adams only because of the slaves who are counted as three-fifths of people. So somebody wrote a book called The Negro President about Jefferson, because without the slave apportionment, Adams would have won. But anyway, Jefferson is in office, and they hate each other. So the Federalists lose Congress, they lose the presidency, and the only thing left is the Supreme Court, which at this time has six justices, Chief Justice John Marshall, who is Jefferson's cousin, by the way, and they loathed each other, because Marshall never forgave Jefferson for A, not fighting in the war. Marshall was at Valley Forge with Washington. Mm. And refusing to send troops to aid Washington because Jefferson thought they needed to remain in Virginia to guard against slave revolts. So in order to maintain power, and Jefferson makes no secret he was going to impeach Marshall and put his friend Spencer Roan as Chief Justice. This case comes up, Marbury versus Madison, which I'm not going to go into detail, but it is a suit by a Federalist named William Marbury, who didn't get a commission he thought he should have, and there it is in the Supreme Court. And Marshall knows if he rules for Jefferson, then he's giving up the power, the last bastion of Federalist power. And if he rules for Marbury, Jefferson's simply going to ignore it and maybe even just kick him out of his job. So Marshall, in a brilliant but totally bogus decision, rules for Jefferson because Marshall said, well, the court has the power to say what the law is, and he establishes in Marbury versus Madison judicial review, which is the power that the court has to overturn a law as unconstitutional.
Right, and this is super important, listeners, because this is going to come in later on. The critical question is, what makes a law constitutional or not? It's a way to push back against the legislative branch.
Right. Now, Antonin Scalia, Justice Scalia, gave a speech in 1996 defining his philosophy called textualism. And he said, I don't care what intent is. I take the words of the Constitution the way they were promulgated to the people of the United States and the fairly understood meaning of those words. So, but there's one exception. Judicial review. It's not in the Constitution. It's nowhere. We made it up. That's a quote. But we made it up very sensibly because the Constitution is a kind of super law, and according to John Marshall, it's the job of the courts to say what the law is. Except that's not true. Marshall may have said it, but William Blackstone, who is kind of the spiritual godfather of all conservative justices, was an English legal theorist, said the court should never be able to overturn a law of the legislature. That leads to tyranny.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with author Lawrence Goldstone about his latest book, Unpunished Murder, Massacre at Colfax, and the Quest for Justice. Now, can you give us an example of how Justice Marshall's decision granting judicial review has impacted U.S. jurisprudence ever since?
For example, in Shelby County versus Holder, where the Supreme Court recently said that the Voting Rights Act, they declared certain aspects of the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional because the country didn't need them. And 1,000 polling places have been closed since Shelby County versus Holder. If John Marshall hadn't stolen that right from the legislature, that Voting Rights Act would still be in effect. Those 1,000 polling places would be open. And all of these laws in southern states to disfranchise African-American voters would be on the books. So what Marshall did had enormous impact. And the second time a law was declared unconstitutional was in the Dred Scott case in 1857, by Roger Taney. So it is of immense power. The reason that we have 9 unelected, serving for life people who basically tell us what the law is in a country that's supposed to elect its leaders is because of John Marshall and because of all the conservative justices who said, oh, we believe in the Constitution, but not this. We like this one.
So you mentioned the Dred Scott decision. What was it, and what was its role in this history?
Dred Scott was a slave who had been brought to a free state and sued for his freedom under an 1820 congressional act called the Missouri Compromise, which delineated which parts of the country could have slavery and which could not. And Dred Scott sued for his freedom because he was in a free state. And the court under Roger Taney, it's T-A-N-E-Y but pronounced Taney, said that Scott was still a slave, and further added that black men had no rights that white men had to accept, and that black men could not be citizens. Mm. Now, President Buchanan had hoped that the Dred Scott case was going to soothe the tensions between North and South, and Buchanan was not one of our poorest presidents for no reason. Of course, all it did was inflame everybody, and ultimately, 3 years later, you had the Civil War. So the Dred Scott case is an infamous decision, considered one of the 3 or 4 worst decisions that the court ever handed down. The irony is that constitutionally, Taney wasn't wrong. The Constitution doesn't, and this is before the Civil War, so it's before the 14th Amendment, the Constitution actually did not protect black people. The people who drafted the Constitution were perfectly happy to make many compromises with slavery. Mm-hmm. So, but it was an inflammatory decision and didn't do anything to soothe the tensions which erupted in the horribly bloody war.
So you just mentioned the 14th Amendment. Tell us about the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments.
The 13th Amendment, which was ratified after it was passed by Congress while Lincoln was alive, but was not ratified until after Lincoln was assassinated. The 14th Amendment said that anyone born in the United States was a citizen, which is why the children of immigrants here illegally are citizens. Anyone born in the United States is a citizen and entitled to the privileges and immunities of citizenship, which means things you're allowed to do and things that can't be taken from you. and that all persons, not all citizens, all persons are entitled to due process of law and equal protection of the laws. The 15th Amendment said that the right to vote shall not be inhibited, it shall not be denied because of race, religion, or previous condition of servitude.
Giving due process to every resident, not just citizens. So that's very relevant to today, when, for example, ICE, Immigration Customs and Enforcement, is arresting people on so-called administrative warrants not signed by a judge, which the ACLU says is a violation of their Fourth Amendment right to due process.
Well, that's how I would read the amendment, and that's how most people read the amendment up until recently. But, you know, there was an umpire, baseball umpire named Bill Clem, and someone was arguing a ball and strike call, and he said, "It's a strike if I say it is." And one of the things we don't realize about our courts is that language isn't objective. Language can have different meanings to different people and can have meanings to some people that are that is utterly ridiculous to other people. And the law is what the courts say it is. And right now, the courts seem to be saying that people who are undocumented are not somehow covered under this 14th Amendment umbrella, but that there are exceptions and certain things can be done which ordinarily you wouldn't think can be done. And the 14th Amendment was perverted in the Cruikshank case, which is what I'm writing about, and the 15th Amendment was also perverted because the 15th Amendment was not ruled to guarantee the right to vote. It was ruled that you couldn't be denied the right to vote because of your race. Now, it sounds like, well, isn't that kind of the same thing? No, it is totally different, because if you are guaranteed the right to vote and someone denies you the right to vote, you say, they have to prove I can't vote. If you are denied the right to vote and you don't really have an absolute right, but only the right not to be denied because of race, you have to go in and prove that's the reason you were denied. So when the Southern states instituted literacy tests and grandfather clauses and poll taxes, many African Americans were shut out of the voting booth and sued. But they lost because the 15th Amendment doesn't guarantee the right to vote.
So was the failure to guarantee the right to vote deliberate or an oversight?
The radical Republicans, they wanted to guarantee the right to vote. There is no question. It was a mistake of language, not a mistake of intent. The people who wrote the 15th Amendment and the people who forced its ratification had no intention of having this loophole in it. But they simply did not account for what people would do to try to work their way around the law. You know, the basic question we're talking about here is the law language or is it an ideal? Is the American Constitution something that we determine by parsing a subordinate clause or by looking and saying this was an attempt to guarantee fundamental justice for, I mean, at the time, white people, but ultimately for all people living in the United States? Because if you look at it that way, then you go, well, come on. Of course they should have the right to vote. You know, of course these people in Georgia should not be denied the right to vote because they had a different letter on their voting and not on their driver's license. Of course Native Americans in the Dakotas should have a right to vote even though they don't have a street address. But if you believe the law is language, you say, well, we'd love to have them vote, but unfortunately this is the way the law reads.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Lawrence Goldstone about his latest book. It's a terrific book for young adults and their parents, Unpunished Murder, Massacre at Colfax, and The Quest for Justice. So let's go to this case now that came out of the massacre at Colfax, Louisiana in 1873. 150 people were involved in the attack on the African Americans in town. 98 were charged, but only 3 were convicted. The local power structure was involved. It was hostile to the rights for black people. How did this even come to trial? And how did they find a prosecutor who would take up the case?
There was a guy named Beckwith, and he was a hero, and he just was devoted to justice. And remember, this is in federal court, so you're dealing with federal judges. They were indicted for violating the First Amendment right of free assembly, peaceable assembly.
Not murder.
Murder was a state crime, and Louisiana wasn't going to do it. There was no state trial. The first trial came to no conclusion, but ultimately these 98 men were tried for violating the civil rights of the black men who were the victims of their invasion, and three were convicted. And again, convicted of conspiracy to violate the First Amendment rights of the African Americans who were killed. And these three men who were convicted, one of them was named Cruikshank, they appealed to the United States Supreme Court. So, yes, the Louisiana, although it was mixed, it was part of Louisiana was a strange state in those days because it was a very strong Republican presence because New Orleans had been overrun by Union troops early in the Civil War. So it had been a kind of refuge for a lot of people who backed the Union, and they had a very thriving African-American community before that. But still, was Louisiana white supremacist? Yeah. And they had the Order of the White Camellia, which was kind of the Ku Klux Klan of the area. So murder was not going to, you're not going to get a trial for that. So the federal government, under this Enforcement Act of 1870, brought these men to trial. Three are convicted. They appealed to the Supreme Court on the grounds that the Enforcement Act of 1870 was unconstitutional because the 14th Amendment didn't give Congress the power to pass that act. The Supreme Court agreed, and the men went free.
What stood out to me is the capriciousness of history. How if there had been different people involved, there would have been a different outcome, and charges wouldn't have been overturned.
Well, you have to recognize something. The court almost always reflects how the people feel at any particular time. This was not a country that welcomed African Americans, freed slaves, freedmen they were called, into society. And this is true in the North as well as the South. People in the North did not want to sit next to African Americans in restaurants. They didn't want to share hotels with them. They didn't want to share public conveyances. Now, they may have grudgingly done it under the law. So these Supreme Court justices held the same views as most of the country and reflected that in their judgments. Now, you had some justices, Samuel Miller being one, who were very much for equal rights, but they were in the minority, and they became even more so as the years went by. And right now, if you look at Judge Kavanaugh, you know, if you look since the year 2000, we're in 2018, we had Barack Obama for 8 years, but we had George Bush, and now we have Donald Trump, and we had George Bush before Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton was kind of was more middle of the road. This country has been dominated by conservatives in our ruling institutions for most of the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. And you look at the court, and there they are. And one thing I'm going to say, democracy is an unforgiving system. If you stay home, the other guy gets to rule. And what I hear Democrats and liberals say all the time is, well, there are more of us than there are of them. But yeah, but you don't vote. Mm-hmm. And if you don't vote, stop complaining.
Lawrence Goldstone. We'll talk more about his book, Unpunished Murder, after this. Lawrence Goldstone. We'll talk more about his book, Unpunished Murder, after this. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today with author Lawrence Goldstone about his book for young adults and their parents, Unpunished Murder, Massacre at Colfax, and the Quest for Justice. It's about a massacre of African Americans that occurred almost 150 years ago and the Supreme Court verdict that overturned their convictions. The case centered around an interpretation of the 14th Amendment, an amendment that's under attack today by our president and his Republican allies. Reading your book, Lawrence Goldstone, I was struck by how many White Americans, like many of the radical Republicans, were defending the right to vote and other equal rights for black people. And how it was lost by a particular reading by one person of the 14th Amendment, one that's so crucial for us today.
I think it's a mistake to think that the radical Republicans were dominant in numbers. They were very much like the conservatives today. There weren't that many of them, but boy, they were relentless and they were ferocious in their beliefs. You know, you have to remember, at the end of the Civil War, slavery was an abomination. When Abraham Lincoln came into office, he was a white supremacist. He didn't believe in mixed marriage. He believed the way to deal with the racial question was to encourage black people to move to Africa. Now, he changed over the course of his presidency, which is what, to me, makes Lincoln such a great president, was that he was capable of learning and growth. So after the Civil War, there are these 4 million freed slaves who had been held under horrific conditions, and the sentiment of the country was, we need to do something for them. And the radical Republicans were in the vanguard of that. And they pushed through a lot of laws, a lot of changes, spent a lot of money, got the army into occupying the South. As time went on, though, people lost the energy. They would say, well, we've done enough. Mm-hmm. Or, well, it's time that they stand on their own 2 feet. Not altogether different than you hear today about the African-American community. And so the radical Republicans, who never represented more than a relatively small minority of even of their own party, began to lose power. Mm-hmm. And the Democratic Party, which was the party who ran on, you know, we've done enough of this, let's get back to other things, the Democratic Party started to gain influence. And ultimately, the Democratic Party took over Congress, and that was the end of any legislation that would favor the freed slaves or would protect the freed slaves. And in 1876, the army was pulled out of the South. And from there, you basically had a down spiral where voting rights and all sorts of rights were taken away from African Americans, and they went to the Supreme Court. But by that time, the court then had totally turned over, was dominated by many of the people on the court that had been corporation lawyers working for the railroads. Mm-hmm. And what they were interested in were the rights of corporations and the right to make money and capitalism. And they were not going to be sidetracked by this unfortunate emphasis on equal rights. The intent of the 14th Amendment was always to protect freedmen, or to protect the African Americans from the very kind of thing that happened at Colfax. But it was written in a way to allow someone who wanted to end run the amendment to say, but it says any state, as opposed to any state and any individual within a state. Now, they probably should have put that in there, but it wouldn't have occurred to them back then that someone was going to end run a constitutional amendment by every one of these decisions was done on the same basis as the 5 conservative justices make decisions today, on the same basis as Citizens United, which said corporations have First Amendment freedom of speech rights. Where did that come from? Well, it actually has a long history going back to the Dartmouth College case, I think in like 1816. Of whether a corporation is a person or not, or what kind of rights. Because what happens in the law is, someone looks and he says, this doesn't mean this, this means this. And then that's precedent.
So in this case, because the 14th Amendment didn't say individuals could violate it as well as states?
The court had a place to go and to say, no, these guys can't be prosecuted. You can't have a law that restricts the right of individuals based on the 14th Amendment, when the 14th Amendment doesn't give you the right to restrict the right of individuals, only states. Now, I will say, now we recognize that the 14th Amendment applies the Bill of Rights to the states. The guy John Bingham, who wrote the 14th Amendment, a congressman from Ohio, the intention was, because remember, the First Amendment does not say people have freedom of speech. It says Congress shall pass no law. State can pass a law saying, you know, freedom of religion. According to the Bill of Rights, a state could pass a law saying you're not allowed to be Catholic. It can say you can't wear a headscarf. But since this period, we have come to recognize that the Bill of Rights guarantees a freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of peaceable assembly, freedom of speech, are incorporated into the 14th Amendment. But back then, Morrison Waite, in his decision, said it's not so. The Bill of Rights does not apply to the states, and because the 14th Amendment only applies to the states, you have no right to bring these people to trial for anything they did. Only Louisiana can do that.
So, if the attackers had been part of a state militia, could they have been convicted?
That is a really interesting question, and you would think, well, yes. This would mean that if a person was acting in an official capacity as a state representative in the militia or as a voting registrar, that that is covered. But no, The court ruled afterwards that the behavior of individuals as state employees is not necessarily covered because they're behaving as individuals. The guarantees only apply if you can prove discrimination, that it goes back to the state law. So ultimately, that's how the black people in the South had the votes taken away from them, because voting registrars were doing all sorts of things, and people brought suit, and they said, no, these guys are, you have to show on a case-by-case basis that this is state discrimination, and they couldn't do it.
So the decision to overturn the conviction of these three happened through a particular reading of how rights under the 14th Amendment were going to be guaranteed, the difference between violations of rights by states or by individuals. Explain the assumption about the 14th Amendment that Beckwith, the prosecutor in the case, was working under and how that changed with this Supreme Court ruling.
Equal protection under the law. The 14th Amendment phrases due process, which is another, we kind of know, it's one of those vague statements. We kind of know what it means, but we don't know what it means practically speaking. I mean, does that mean that everybody has to be have a lawyer? Well, I mean, that's the Fifth Amendment, but there are aspects of due process, meaning that you're supposed to move in an orderly way through the judicial system, that don't seem to apply to everybody. Now remember, 14th Amendment says any person, not any citizen. But you see these pictures of these small children in court having to face an immigration lawyer. Now, is that a violation of due process?
Immigration judge.
Oh, sorry, yes, immigration judge. You would say, well, that's, if anything is a violation of due process, that's a violation. But it isn't. So again, the law means what people say it means. Equal protection of the laws has the meaning that the courts have decided it is. I mean, that is the most important thing for people to recognize. When they say, this is an injustice, well, yes, but the way you change injustice is by changing the men dispensing justice and women. And the way you change the men and women dispensing justice is by changing the people who appoint those men and women. And you only do that by voting.
So after writing this book, Unpunished Murder, Lawrence Goldstone, what was the most important thing you learned during writing it that you want us to know?
Well, I want people to recognize that the Constitution is something that you make. The Constitution, you know, Antonin Scalia used to say, I believe in a dead Constitution, meaning it means now what it meant then. But there is no such thing. It always changes. In 1939, there was a case, U.S. v. Miller, which was a sawed-off shotgun case. And Miller, who was a bank robber, sued because his Second Amendment rights were violated because he carried a shotgun across state lines and was arrested. And the court unanimously ruled that's ridiculous. This has no meaning for militia. This has no military purpose. It's a sawed-off shotgun. And Miller was... And then in 2008, Scalia writes in D.C. v. Heller that people, you know, have a right, that the Second Amendment doesn't mean that. I want people to recognize that the Constitution is going to mean what the people in power say it means. And if the people in power are of goodwill, the Constitution is going to protect the rights of many people who are weak and helpless. If they are not of goodwill, as we see it, the Constitution is going to protect the rights of the rich and powerful. There is no other way. I mean, that's the most important thing that I want to get across. But I wrote the book because I also believe that students, high school students and their parents, I believe that you can interest students because that's where the future is. If you want people to change things, it isn't going to be us. It's going to be them. And they're not going to change things if all they read about is vampires. And when I wrote this, because I am convinced that these kinds of stories can be every bit as interesting and every bit as compelling to high school students and their parents and librarians as pulpy fiction. So those are the two things I want everybody to come away with.
Well, it absolutely accomplishes that. It's a page-turner. Unpublished Murder, Massacre at Colfax, and The Quest for Justice. Lawrence Goldstone, this has been such an interesting and important conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Lawrence Goldstone is the author of numerous works of fiction and nonfiction, several of which deal with constitutional law and race in American history, including Dark Bargain, Inherently Unequal, The Betrayal of Equal Rights by the Supreme Court, and his latest, Unpunished Murder. Read an excerpt from Unpunished Murder at writersvoice.net. Next, she insisted, persisted, and resisted. We're talking about Elizabeth Warren, of course, and a book about her for kids. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Children's book author Susan Wood has written a number of biographies for children, including one about artist Grant Wood and Mexican musician Juan Garcia Esquivel. Now she's come out with a picture book biography of U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren. The book doesn't focus so much on politics as it does on character. Warren's support for economic justice for America's poor and middle classes, and of course, her penchant for persistence. That was most celebrated, or shall we say scorned, by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell when he complained that despite the Republican majority's attempt to silence her, Warren persisted in reading a letter from Coretta Scott King into the record during Attorney General Jeff Sessions' confirmation hearing. In her book, Elizabeth Warren, Nevertheless She Persisted, Susan Wood goes back to Warren's childhood for the roots to her persistence in defending the rights of those who are socially and economically marginalized. Although the book is for grade schoolers, parents will learn from it too, and the accompanying illustrations are charming. Well, Susan Wood, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
So, why did you want to write a book about Elizabeth Warren?
I have always admired Elizabeth Warren. She's so smart, and she's just absolutely fearless, which I adore, and she never gives up. She's always ready to stand up and speak out for what she believes in, for those who need her help. And so I wanted to find out where that comes from. So as I began to learn more about her life experiences, especially in her childhood, and how she was shaped by them, I thought her story might appeal to young readers and maybe even inspire them to find their own voices, just as she did.
Yeah, so let's start there. Tell us about her childhood. You start the book by saying it's no surprise that Elizabeth Warren grew up to be a fighter.
Yeah, well, she grew up in a middle-class community in Oklahoma. And when she was 12, her father had a heart attack. So he couldn't work for a while. And that left her family really scraping to make ends meet. In fact, they lost the family car that she loved, her favorite station wagon, and they were about to lose their house. So she watched her mother fight to keep their home. And the way her mother did this was by going to work. And this was at a time when most kids at Elizabeth's school, their moms were homemakers. So that was, unusual for her. But that was kind of the pivotal moment, I think, when she started looking around and noticing the way the world works and noticing things like economic differences. So she took her mother's example and fought the way she could as a child, going to work by earning money for the family, babysitting and waitressing and sewing. Then in high school, she joined the debate team, and that's where she learned to fight with her words. At that time, girls were generally expected to, you know, be sweet and quiet and study home ec, but she was up there debating with the boys. She became state debate champion, and that got her a scholarship to college, which her family could never have afforded to send her to otherwise. So in high school, she learned to fight with her words.
I think I'm contemporaneous with Elizabeth Warren. I remember those home ec classes, and I also remember about how women were really had a certain place and were not supposed to challenge men or boys in any way.
She definitely broke the mold in that regard.
She got a scholarship to college. Where did she go to college, and what did she decide to study there?
Well, she went to several colleges, but she got married in the interim, so they moved around. But she eventually became a lawyer, and that's where she started fighting for families like hers who were struggling middle class. She specialized in bankruptcy law, so in college she was doing lots of research, and as a law professor as well, a lot of research into economic disparity and why the middle class kept getting the raw deal.
She became a lawyer. That also was pretty unusual for a girl as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And in fact, she had some trouble being both she had a family, so she was a mother, and she was taking care of kids. She didn't immediately have luck finding work as an attorney. So instead of banging her head against the wall, she just went ahead and hung up her own shingle. And so she set up her own law practice right there at her house so she could be both mom and lawyer at the same time.
Now, before she became a lawyer, I learned something surprising from your book, Elizabeth Warren, Nevertheless, She Persisted. She was a teacher for kids with special needs.
Yes, she was.
Tell us more about that and about what happened when she got pregnant.
She wasn't a teacher for long. I think it was only just a year after she immediately got out of college. And she taught for a year, and then she got pregnant with her daughter, and the school didn't ask her back to teach any longer.
Because she was pregnant.
I wouldn't directly say that, and she didn't directly say that in her autobiography, which is, you know, my main primary source for research in this book was her actual writings, including her books. And so she never comes right out and says that's why. But, I think we can infer that's why.
Yeah, I think we probably can. I don't believe teachers were allowed to teach if they were pregnant back in those days. So she became a lawyer, as you say, and specialized in bankruptcy. Why do you think she specialized in that?
Well, it was really close to her heart because she remembered her own childhood and how scary it can be when you're living on the edge of poverty, trying to make ends meet. Their car got repossessed. They almost lost their house, and she watched all that happen and the toll that it took on her mom and her dad. I think it was just really close to her heart. It continues to be.
Now, when a whole lot of other people went bankrupt, that was during the 2007-2008 financial crisis, she was actually appointed to oversee the TARP. And now I've forgotten what that acronym stands for, but
Troubled Asset Relief Program.
Troubled Asset Relief Program, exactly. Although they didn't really trouble to relieve the assets of most homeowners, mostly the banks, who caused the problem to begin with. What was her job there, and why do you think she got appointed?
She was the leader of the Congressional Oversight Panel for TARP. And she was appointed to that because she had become an expert in Washington, D.C. She would advise the National Bankruptcy Review Commission, which was a committee that studied banking laws that was hurting struggling families. So she was an expert already in her field, and she had been testifying in front of Congress as an expert on things. So she was, you know, they were familiar with her. She was familiar with them, I think, is probably the main reason.
And then she was, you know, widely expected to take the helm of the newly created Consumer Finance Protection Board, the CFPB. But she didn't get that. Why do you think she didn't get to be the head of that agency? One that, in fact, the existence of which she's probably most responsible for creating.
Right. In my research, it seemed to be a mostly political thing. And in this book for children, I completely tried to keep the politics out of it.
Why is that?
Because I don't think children of this age really understand or, more importantly, care that much about the machinations of our political system. And I do think they care, on the other hand, about things like fairness and helping others and speaking up for yourself and your beliefs, how to handle obstacles that might come your way, which is what I've tried to show with the persistence of someone like Elizabeth Warren. So you'll note in the book that I don't mention any political parties. I don't specifically mention any political figures by name. I wanted to keep the politics out of this and focus on Elizabeth Warren's growth over the course of her life. First on her as, you know, when she was very young, she was started out as an observer, as a child watching the world and the way it works, how it doesn't always seem fair, like when your family loses your car and your house almost, and only because your dad happened to have a heart attack. And then as a learner, so she moves from observer to learner as a young woman in high school and college, as she, you know, finds her voice through debate and law school, and finds her passions like researching and teaching about and standing up for the middle class. And finally, you know, culminating as someone who takes action, who stands up for herself and others, even when there are obstacles placed in her way or others telling her to sit down and be quiet. So the focus is on her personal growth story and moving from girl to senator, finding her voice and using it to speak up for herself and others.
Right. And, you know, without putting too fine a point on it, however, one of the people, I mean, the very person who excoriated Elizabeth Warren for persisting was Jeff Sessions. But nevertheless, she persisted. So tell us about that. What happened and what role did Sessions play in that, our attorney general under President Trump?
Well, that incident, yeah, that was during his nomination hearings. And that's a perfect example of this mantra that I've repeated throughout the book, insist, resist, persist. She felt very strongly that it was important for the Senate to hear a letter that Coretta Scott King had written. So she tried several times to read it within the Senate chamber. And when a rarely used rule was invoked there in the chamber to silence her, she just went right outside the door and, you know, on Facebook Live, read every last word of the letter. So it was broadcast to millions more people who would have known about it or seen it had she been allowed to read it in the chamber only. So she, you know, she insisted on reading the letter.
And we should say, I mean, it was about his record, his abysmal record on civil rights. Yeah, and I think that that's a key context for people to understand that Coretta Scott King, you know, Jeff Sessions is a segregationist.
Yeah, absolutely.
So she read the letter of Coretta Scott King in which she made it clear that Jeff Sessions' record on civil rights was a really bad one, and that's why she didn't think that he should be confirmed as the top cop in the nation enforcing our civil rights. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So she knew that the letter needed to be heard. And if she couldn't read it within the Senate chamber, she was going to find another way. She was going to persist, as she was told Nevertheless, she persisted. Yes, she did. She went right outside the Senate and read the letter that she felt very strongly needed to be heard. So she insisted on reading the letter, resisted by refusing to be silenced, and persisted by doing what she had to do, following her heart and standing up and speaking out.
Now, talk about her decision to become a U.S. senator. I mean, she had never run for office before.
Right, and Massachusetts had never had a woman senator before. In fact, she still thought of herself as a teacher, even though, you know, she had been having all these experiences in D.C. So she just felt that there were so many things that still needed fixing, especially with regard to the middle class and how the playing field didn't seem very level in regard to, you know, banking rules and the 1%. And so she went and traveled across Massachusetts to listen to citizens and find out where their concerns are and share what she knew. And finally, at one of these backyard listening sessions, a woman came up to her and said, "You know, I've lost my job. I lost my car. I walked 2 miles to get here to see you and talk to you. I want you to fight for me. Will you please run for Senate?" And so that kind of tipped her hand, and that's what inspired her finally to say, "Yeah, I'll stand up for everyone and fight for everyone."
President Trump has refuses to refer to her by name. He calls her by a very, you know, kind of scornful, rudely meant moniker, Pocahontas, referring to her family's stories that she has some Native American in her background. She has responded to them. She's come right back at him. Let's say she's resisted and persisted, but in quite a different manner. And I wonder if you could kind of contrast the way she takes up the battle cry and, you know, the way that Trump wields his cudgel.
Well, that's what I find really remarkable about her, is as low as others go in trying to attack her, she does seem to always take the high road. And she's not afraid to, you know, take the high road in a very fierce and ferocious manner. She doesn't take any crap. And I so admire that about her, her total fierceness and toughness and refusal to back down. And I have a teenage daughter, and I would hope that if someone attacked her in that way, that she would take the high road, yes, but you know, have no qualms about standing up for herself.
Well, Susan Wood, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about your book for kids, Elizabeth Warren, Nevertheless, She Persisted.
Thank you.
Susan Wood. Check out the trailer for Elizabeth Warren, Nevertheless, She Persisted, at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.